Hey there. In this section, Henry talks about food, and he talks about all of his accounting and, you know, what it really took to feed himself during these 2 years. And in a way, he talks about how he also reinvented making bread, meaning that he didn't really need salt. He didn't really need yeast. So, you know, this is for all of you out there who might have been doing sourdough and sourdough starters and doing a lot of baking and reinventing for yourselves during COVID. Anyway, give a listen. Before I finished my house, wishing to earn $10 or $12 by some honest and agreeable method, in order to meet my unusual expenses, I planted about 2.5 acres of light and sandy soil near it, chiefly with beans, but also a small part with potatoes, corn, peas, and turnips. The whole lot contains 11 acres, mostly growing up to pines and hickories, and was sold the preceding season for $8.08 an acre. One farmer said that it was good for nothing but to raise cheeping squirrels on. I put no manure whatever on the land, not being the owner, but merely a squatter, and not expecting to cultivate so much again, and I did not quite hoe it all at once. I got out several cords of stumps and plowing, which supplied me with fuel for a long time, and left small circles of virgin mold easily distinguishable through the summer by the greater luxuriance of the beans there. The dead and for the most part unmerchantable wood behind my house and the driftwood from the pond have supplied the remainder of my fuel. I was obliged to hire a team and a man for the plowing, though I held the plow myself. My farm outgoes for the first seasons were, for implements, seed, work, and etc., $14.72. The seed corn was given me. This never costs anything to speak of, unless you plant more than enough. I got 12 bushels of beans and 18 bushels of potatoes, besides some peas and sweet corn. The yellow corn and turnips were too late to come to anything. My whole income from the farm was $23.44, deducting the outgoes $14.72, there are left $8.71. Besides produce consumed and on hand at the time this estimate was made of the value of $4.50, the amount on hand much more than balancing a little grass, which I did not raise. All things considered, that is, considering the importance of a man's soul and of today, notwithstanding the short time occupied by my experiment, nay, partly even because of its transient character, I believe that was doing better than any farmer in Concord did that year. The next year, I did better still, for I spaded up all the land which I required, about 1/3 acre, and I learned from the experience of both years, not being in the least awed by many celebrated works on husbandry, Arthur Young among the rest, that if one would live simply and eat only the crop which he raised, and raise no more than he ate, and not exchange it for insufficient quantity of more luxurious and expensive things, he would need to cultivate only a few rods of ground, and that would be cheaper to spade up than to use oxen to plow it, and to select a fresh spot from time to time than to manure the old, and he could do all his necessary farm work, as it were, with his left hand at odd hours in the summer, and thus would not be tied to an ox or horse or cow or pig as at present. I desire to speak impartially on this point, and as not one interested in the success or failure of the present economical and social arrangements. I was more independent than any farmer in Concord, for I was not anchored to a house or farm, but could follow the bent of my genius, which is a very crooked one, every moment. Besides being better off than they already, if my house had been burned and my crops had failed, I should have been nearly as well off as before. I want to think that men are not so much the keepers of herds as herds are the keepers of men. The former are so much the freer. Men and oxen exchange work, but if we consider necessary work only, the oxen will be seen to have greater the advantage. Their farm is so much the larger. Man does some of his part of the exchange work in his 6 weeks of haying, and it is no boy's play. Certainly, no nation that lived simply in all respects, that is, no nation of philosophers, could commit to so great a blunder as to use the labor of animals. True, there never was and is not likely soon to be a nation of philosophers, nor am I certain it is desirable that there should be. However, I should have never have broken a horse or bull and taken him to board for any work he might do for me, for fear I should become a horseman or a herdsman merely. And if society seems to be the gainer by so doing, are we certain that what is one man's gain is not another's loss, and that the stable boy has equal cause with his master to be satisfied? Granted that some public works should not have been constructed without this aid, and let man share the glory of such with the ox and horse, does it follow that he could not have accomplished works yet more worthy of himself in that case? When men began to do, not merely unnecessary or artistic, but luxurious and idle work, with their assistance, it is inevitable that few do all the exchange work with the oxen, or in other words, become the slaves of the strongest. Man thus not only works for the animal within him, but for a symbol of this, he works for the animal without him. Though we have many substantial houses of brick or stone, the prosperity of the farmer is still measured by the degree to which the barn overshadows the house. This town is said to have the largest houses for oxen, cows, and horses thereabouts, and it is not behindhand in its public buildings. But there are very few halls for free worship or free speech in this country. It should not be by their architecture, but why not even by their power of abstract thought, that nations should seek to commemorate themselves. How much more admirable the Bhagavad Gita than all the ruins of the East? Towers and temples are the luxury of princes. A simple and independent mind does not toil at the bidding of any prince. Genius is not a retainer to any emperor, nor is its material silver or gold or marble, except to a trifling extent. To what end, pray, is so much stone hammered? Is Arcadia, when I was there? In Arcadia, when I was there, I did not see any hammering stone. Nations are possessed with an insane ambition to perpetuate the memory of themselves by the amount of hammered stone they leave. What if equal pains were taken to smooth and polish their manners? One piece of good sense would be more memorable than a monument as high as the moon. I love better to see stones in place. The grandeur of Thebes was a vulgar grandeur. More sensible is a rod of stone wall that bounds an honest man's field than the hundred-gated Thebes that was wandered farther from the true end of life. The religion and civilization which are barbaric and heathenish build splendid temples, but what you might call Christianity does not. Most of the stone a nation hammer goes toward its tomb only. It buries itself alive. As for the pyramids, there is nothing to wonder at in them so much as the fact that so many men could be found degraded enough to spend their lives constructing a tomb for some ambitious booby, whom it would have been wiser and manlier to have drowned in the Nile and then given his body to the dogs. I might possibly invent some excuse for them and him, but I have no time for it. As for the religion and love of art of the builders, it is much the same all the world over, whether the building be an Egyptian temple or the United States Bank. It costs more than it comes to. The mainspring is vanity, assisted by the love of garlic and bread and butter. Mr. Balcom, a promising young architect, designs it on the back of his Vitruvius with hard pencil and ruler, and the job is to let out to Dobson and Sons stonecutters. When the 30 centuries begin to look down on it, mankind begins to look up at it. As for your high towers and monuments, there was a crazy fellow once in this town who undertook to dig through to China, and he got so far that, as he said, he heard the Chinese pots and kettles rattle. But I think I shall not go out of my way to admire the hole which he made. Many are concerned about the monuments of the West and East, to know who built them. For my part, I should like to know who in those days did not build them, who were above such trifling. But to proceed to my statistics. By surveying, carpentry, and day labor of various other kinds in the village in the meanwhile, for I have as many trades as fingers, I had earned $13.34. The expense of food for 8 months, namely from July 4th to March 1st, the time when those estimates were made, though I lived there more than 2 years, not counting potatoes, a little green corn, and some peas which I had raised, nor considering the value of what was on hand at the last date was. Rice, $1.73.5. Molasses, $1.73, cheapest form of the saccharin. Rye meal, $1.04 and 3/4. Indian meal, 99¾ cents, cheaper than rye. Pork, 22 cents. Flour, 88 cents. Costs more than Indian meal, both money and trouble. Sugar, 80 cents. Lard, 65 cents. Apples, 25 cents. Dried apple, 22 cents. Sweet potatoes, 10 cents. One pumpkin, 6 cents. One watermelon, 2 cents. Salt, 3 cents. All of the last experiments which failed. Everything from flour to salt. Yes, I did eat $8.74 all told, but I should not thus unblushingly publish my guilt if I did not know that most of my readers were equally guilty with myself, and that their deeds would look no better in print. The next year I sometimes caught a mess of fish for my dinner, and once I went so far as to slaughter a woodchuck, which ravaged my bean field, effect his transmigration, as a Tartar would say, and devour him, partly for experiment's sake. But though it afforded me a momentary enjoyment, notwithstanding a musky flavor, I saw that the longest use would not make that a good practice. However, it might seem to have your woodchucks ready dressed by the village butcher. Clothing and some incidental expenses within the same dates, though little can be inferred from this item, amounted to oil and some household utensils, $2. Plus $8.40¾. So all the pecuniary outgoes, excepting for washing and mending, which for the most part were done out of the house, and their bills have not yet been received. And these are all and more than all the ways by which money necessarily goes out in this part of the world, were house, $28.12½. Farm 1 year, $14.72½. Food 8 months, $8.74. Clothing and etc. 8 months, $8.40¾. Oil and etc. 8 months, $2. In all, $61.99¾. I address myself now to those of my readers who have a living to get, and to meet this, I have for farm produce sold $23.44, earned by day labor, $13.34, in all, $36.78, which subtracted from the sums of the outgoes leaves a balance of $25.21¾ on one side, this being very nearly the means with which I started, and the measure of expenses to be incurred. And on the other, besides the leisure and independence and health thus secured, a comfortable house for me as long as I choose to occupy it. These statistics, however accidental and therefore uninstructive they may appear, as they have a certain completeness, have a certain value also. Nothing was given me of which I have not rendered some account. It appears from the above estimate that my food alone cost me in money about 27 cents a week. It was, for nearly 2 years after this, rye and Indian meal without yeast, potatoes, rice, a very little salt pork, molasses and salt, and my drink water. It was fit that I should live on rice, mainly, who loved so well the philosophy of India. To meet the objections of some inveterate cavaliers, I might as well state that if I dined out occasionally, as I always had done, and I trust shall have opportunities to do again, it was frequently to the detriment of my domestic arrangements. But the dining out being, as I have stated, a constant element, does not in the least affect a comparative statement like this. I learned from my 2 years' experience that it would cost incredibly little trouble to obtain one's necessary food, even in this latitude, that a man may use as simple a diet as the animals, and yet retain health and strength. I have made a satisfactory dinner, satisfactory on several accounts, simply off a dish of purslane, Portulaca or Elracia, which I gathered in my cornfield, boiled and salted. I give the Latin on account of the savoriness of the trivial name. And pray, what more can a reasonable man desire in peaceful times, in ordinary noons, than a sufficient number of ears of green sweet corn boiled with the addition of salt? Even the little variety which I used was a yielding to the demands of appetite and not of health. Yet men have come to such a pass that they frequently starve, not for want of necessaries, but for want of luxuries. And I know a good woman who thinks that her son lost his life because he took to drinking water only. The reader will perceive that I'm treating the subject rather from an economic than a dietetic point of view, and he will not venture to put my abstemiousness to the test unless he has a well-stocked larder. Bread I at first made of pure Indian meal and salt, genuine hoe cakes, which I baked before my fire out of doors, on a shingle, or the end of a stick of timber sawed off in my building, in building my house. But it was wont to get smoked and to have a piney flavor. I tried flour also, but I have at last found a mixture of rye and Indian meal most convenient and agreeable. In cold weather, it was no little amusement to bake several small loaves of this in succession, tending and turning them as often as an Egyptian his hatching eggs. They were a real cereal fruit which I ripened, and they had to my senses a fragrance like that of other noble fruits, which I kept in as long as possible by wrapping them in cloths. I made a study of the ancient and indispensable art of bread making, consulting such authorities as offered, going back to the primitive days and the first invention of the unleavened kind, when from the wildness of nuts and meats men first reached the mildness and refinement of this diet, and traveling gradually down in my studies through that accidental souring of the dough, which, it is supposed, taught the leavening process, and through the various fermentations thereafter, till I came to a good, sweet, wholesome bread, the staff of life. Leaven, which does deem the soul of bread, the spiritus, which fills its cellular tissue, which is religiously preserved like the vestal fire, some precious bottleful, I suppose, first brought over in the Mayflower, did the business for America, and its influence is still rising, swelling, spreading, its cerulean billows over the land. This seed I regularly and faithfully procured from the village, till at length one morning I forgot the rules and scalded my yeast, by which accident I discovered that even this was not indispensable, for my discoveries were not by the synthetic but analytic process, and I have gladly omitted it since, though most housewives earnestly assured me that safe and wholesome bread without yeast might not be. And elderly people prophesied a speedy decay of the vital forces. Yet I find it not to be an essential ingredient, and after going without it for a year, I'm still in the land of the living, and I'm glad to escape the trivialness of carrying a bottleful in my pocket, which would sometimes pop and discharge its contents to my discomfiture. It is simpler and more respectable to admit it, to omit it. Man is an animal who more than any other can adapt himself to all climates and circumstances. Neither did I put in any sal soda or any other acid or alkali into my bread. It would seem that I made it according to the recipe which Marcus Porcius Cato gave about 2 centuries before Christ. Panem depsicium sic facio, manus mortarium qui bene lavato, farinum in mortarium inditu, aquae paulitem aditu, subigoti pulcri, ubi beni subgeneris defingito, coqui sub testu, which I take to mean, make kneaded bread thus. Wash your hands and trough well. Put the meal into the trough, add water gradually, and knead it thoroughly. When you have kneaded it well, mold it and bake it under a cover. That is, in a baking kettle. Not a word about leaven. But I did not always use this staff of life. At one time, owing to the emptiness of my purse, I saw none of it for more than a month. Every New Englander might easily raise all his own breadstuffs in this land of rye and Indian corn, and not depend on distant and fluctuating markets for them. Yet so far are we from simplicity and independence that, in Concord, fresh and sweet meal is rarely sold in the shops, and hominy and corn, in still a coarser form, are hardly used by any. For the most part, the farmer gives to his cattle and hogs the grain of his own producing, and buys flour. which is at least no more wholesome at a greater cost at the store. I saw that I could easily raise my bushel or two of rye and Indian corn, for the former will grow on the poorest land, and the latter does not require the best, and grind them in a handmill, and do so without rice and pork. And if I must have some concentrated sweet, I found by experiment that I could make a very good molasses, either of pumpkins or of beets. And I knew I needed only to set out a few maples to obtain it more easily still. And while these were growing, I could use various substitutes besides those which I have named. For, as the forefathers sang, we can make liquor to sweeten our lips of pumpkin and parsnips and walnut tree chips. Finally, as for salt, that grossest of groceries, to obtain this might be a fit occasion for a visit to the seashore. Or, if I did without it altogether, I should probably drink the less water. I do not learn that the Indians ever troubled themselves to go after it. Thus, I could avoid all trade and barter, so far as my food was concerned, and having a shelter already, it would only remain to get clothing and fuel. The pantaloons which I now wear were woven in a farmer's family. Thank heaven there is so much virtue still in man, for I think the fall from the farmer to the operative is great and memorable as that from the man to the farmer. And in a new country, fuel is an encumbrance. As for habitat, if I were not permitted still to squat, I might purchase 1 acre at the same price for which the land I cultivated was sold, namely $8.08. But as it was, I consider that I enhance the value of the land by squatting on it. There is a certain class of unbelievers who sometimes ask me such questions as, if I think that I can live on vegetable food alone, and to strike at the root of the matter at once, for the root is faith. I am accustomed to answer such, that I can live on board nails. If they cannot understand that, they cannot understand much that I have to say. For my part, I am glad to hear of experiments of this kind being tried, as that a young man tried for a fortnight to live on hard, raw corn on the ear, using his teeth for all mortar. The squirrel tribe tried the same and succeeded. The human race is interested in these experiments, though a few old women who are incapacitated for them, who own their third in mills, may be alarmed. Hey there. So I just read a very long section where Henry talks about he essentially creates a narrative of all of his accounts. Quite honestly, I had been dreading reading this section, just because I knew that there were a lot of, you know, what I had thought were tedious lists of, you know, the accounting of how much he spent on food. And, you know, it seemed, you know, accounting has never been my most favorite subject. And it's really funny how much he actually dwells on this. But another reason that I had been putting off reading this section, was that, and this is personal, so apologies, but my mother had, actually passed away in this past month, maybe a week or so, a week and a few days after I released the last episode, or the episode prior to this one. And it was very odd because I had been, reading sections of Walden as I was waiting for her to finish her doctor's appointments, because I would have to wait in the car because of COVID restrictions and things. So I was in a very weird place and have been and still am. But after reading this section today, there's the romantic part of me, and then there's also the very analytic part of me. And I've noticed that a lot lately, that it's actually very important to be able to hold both of those pieces of yourself, and actually, you know, all pieces of yourself, kind of in the way that Henry does, because, if you are not keeping track of your accounts, if you're not, you know, making sure that you get food and the very basics that you need to live, that your experiment as a life is really not going to work. And so I've been noticing this personally, you know, without the benefit of having my my beautiful dear mother around. And I noticed, especially in the section where he talks about, and I feel like it's actually funny in the food section, where he talks about making bread, and he's like, you know what? I don't actually need yeast. I don't actually need like flavoring or salt or anything. And I always think that's so funny, because when you're trying to cook for yourself, you know, and not that I would understand this, but you know, no matter how terrible, whatever it is that you've made, like, because you've made it, it tastes pretty good, and you're very likely to eat it and be completely happy with it and, you know, think that it's really great. But I think if you are in the role of a mother or somebody who is baking and cooking for others, you actually have to make it palatable. So, I feel like I see this in a lot of blogs and articles about, people, and not, you know, not just men, but quite often men or people who have never been in the role of, being expected to cook for others. My mother was actually one of 8 kids, and, you know, she was she was one of the later kids. So she had her older sisters who would try to teach her how to cook and would always be so critical of her, literally to the point where she never cooked for enjoyment. And she could cook. She actually like made lots of delicious meals. But, you know, she never took joy out of it, and she never wanted to cook for, you know, large groups of people. She was happy to make some for our little family, and everything was great. But I think that if you are trying to reinvent the wheel, I think like Henry is doing, with bread and stuff, it turns into a really funny, situation, because, you know, he's like, I could totally live off of this terrible bread. And as we actually know from, you know, accounts at the time, and I'm not sure if he admits it here in Walden, but there's this running joke that he actually went home and had Sunday dinners with his mother, you know, and she would make him pies and his sister would bring him cookies and like all sorts of things. So he's, at least in this section, he's trying to be very proud of like, you know, I learned a new way to make bread and I'm fine and I could live like this forever, even though I only had to live on this for like 2 years. And he's like, and you know, and after all this time, I'm still alive, you know, and there's some woman out there who thinks that her son died because he only drank water, you know, and didn't drink wine and whatever. So he's trying to advocate for this really, you know, abstemious kind of diet. But there is, and I think he mentions it later in Walden. I actually have to, I think we will find out through our reading. But it is well known that he did not survive on bread and water, that he went home and also, you know, got lots of benefit from his family's cooking. And also he mentioned something about his clothing, when he's like, you know, it got mended out of the house, meaning he took it back to his mother, you know, or he hired somebody to fix it, or he took it back to her and maybe she hired somebody to fix it. But like those numbers do not appear here. And I feel like that's part of the whole character of having a mother or having other people in your community to help take care of you, because it's one of those things that you don't have to account for with money, and other people, you know, just because they're giving you their time or they're paying for it themselves, or, you know, they're asking someone else to do it, like it's work and it gets done. But if you know, and this goes back to the very analytic piece, but if you don't have to pay for it, it doesn't appear on your ledger. And it's sort of very easy to not value that piece of it, you know, to just sort of assume that, oh, the pants get mended by themselves. which he sort of, you know, elides over here. But I think about that when it comes specifically to caretaking or babysitting, that there are, especially now in America because of COVID, this is something that sort of we're realizing as a society that this is a major job. And, you know, there's not always money to pay for it. And if you're not giving money, then you're giving time. And somebody has to do the caretaking. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. And then that leads to, you know, worse consequences, or the kids, you know, get in trouble or get hurt, heaven forbid, or, you know, the elderly get hurt as well. So it's funny that Henry is so particular, and he talks so much about, you know, his farm and the fact that, you know, that the whole lot contains 11 acres, and this is in Walden. This is up, you know, in the hills. If you go to Walden, you can actually go and find Henry's bean field. I think there's a little bit of a marker. You can go to his house, and there are paths leading away from the pond. And if you explore those paths, you can find the bean field. But he mentioned specifically that, you know, and when you go there, it's like full of trees. So it's actually hard to imagine that it wasn't as forested as it was. Like back in Henry's time, the trees were being used for firewood. So, you know, when he talks about, you know, clearing the land or plowing the land, there actually weren't that many trees. So, you know, it's a kind of a different landscape now. But the very fact that they were sold the preceding season for $8.08 an acre. And he doesn't mention that it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who bought it. And that Ralph Waldo Emerson happened to buy it because he was wandering around Walden and he came across the people who were auctioning it off, and he decided to buy it, which is like one of the most amazing happenstances in literature that doesn't really get called out. But if Waldo hadn't been going for a walk that day, like this whole Walden experiment wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened at Walden. It might've happened somewhere else, but it wouldn't have happened at Walden. And also just going over like actually how much his crops, actually produced: 12 bushels of beans, 18 bushels of potatoes, and some peas and sweet corn. I've tried to be a gardener during COVID, and I have no idea how much how he can get all that. One of the really great jokes is when he sort of subtly talks about the woodchuck. And if you have been a gardener and you have had a woodchuck in your yard, which happened to me last year, they drive you crazy. They absolutely dig up everything that they can find. And I feel like they do it with a smile on their face, because they're one of the few animals that kind of shows up in the middle of the day. And they just run around, and they're like fat and large, like a big block of wood, but furry. So it's not like they're chipmunks, you know, where they're sleek and they're trying to run around really quickly. No, these are big fat animals that, you know, have power behind them. I actually wish that he had written a narrative about like his fight with a woodchuck, because that was a little too funny. We always talk about him as like this, you know, Saint Francis of Assisi, where he can, you know, whistle to the birds and the birds come, and the chipmunks and the squirrels and all that. But I think it's really funny that his one adversary is the woodchuck. I think it's also funny when he's talking about the men are not so much the keepers of herds as herds are the keepers of men, because he keeps talking about this whole idea of, you know, you shouldn't be shackled to your work because the work is going to shackle you eventually anyway. So you should be careful about that. He's always sort of calling out the idea that, you know, we're here to live and we're not just here to work. And I think that he spends like a page or two sort of talking about the architecture and how it's sort of bizarre that, you know, not only are we the slaves of our oxen, but we're also making the oxen work for us. You know, man thus not only works for the animal within him, but for a symbol of this, he works for the animal without him. Though we have many substantial houses of brick or stone, the prosperity of the farmer is still measured by the degree to which the barn overshadows the house. So, you know, and he sort of is talking about how, like, the temples that we build and the grandeur of the barn, it's like we're way more interested in creating these physical objects that show how rich we are and how hard we work. And so those are sort of the elements that we give weight to, or emotional weight, or, you know, financial weight, as if that, you know, the barn is, you know, the larger symbol of how good we are morally or how outstanding we are. And then he has this really great line: how much more admirable the Bhagavad Gita than all the ruins of the East. Towers and temples are the luxury of princes. A simple and independent mind does not toil at the bidding of any prince. Genius is not a retainer to any emperor, nor is its material silver or gold or marble, except to a trifling extent. So to what end, pray, is so much stone hammered? In Arcadia, when I was there, I did not see any hammering stone. And Arcadia, I believe, is a fictional place that he's referring to. And, you know, he's like, the world of the mind is so much more tangible, or should be way more honored than the world that we see. The ruins of all these princes and stuff is sort of silly. And then he actually mentions Thebes. The grandeur of Thebes was a vulgar grandeur. And as you remember, Thebes is in Egypt. And it was actually known as the legendary, or so the land of Thebes. He mentions Thebes. The grandeur of Thebes was a vulgar grandeur. And he, you know, Thebes is this place that is known specifically because of Oedipus, who is this mythological king of Thebes. And it's known, you know, Oedipus, the whole play cycle, there are three plays. But Oedipus the king is the most well known. And that is the story of this guy who goes to an oracle, and the oracle tells him, you're going to kill your father and marry your mother. So he, you know, runs off, and he's like, well, why don't I just, like, never see them again, so this won't happen. And then, you know, he's on the road, and, you know, because of, you know, like, craziness there's essentially like a traffic jam or whatever, and he gets mad at this guy who's hogging the road, and he kills him, and I think he kills also like his whole entourage as well. And, you know, and whatever the legend is, he then becomes king of Thebes. And not only does he become king, but he also gets to marry the queen, which is like the worst result of road rage that can ever happen. But, you know, this is how the legend plays out. And then in the end, and, you know, spoiler alert, he discovers that this king and queen had originally been his original parents. And they had also gone to an oracle who told them that this child was going to kill the father and marry the mother. And they're like, oh my God, this is horrible. So they left the baby on a mountaintop to die of exposure. And they had, you know, they gave the kid to a poor shepherd. And, you know, the poor shepherd was like, I can't deal with this. So he gave it to a couple, because the shepherd was a nice guy. And it was, there's also something to do. Oh, the baby was, they drilled something in his ankles or something. It was really horrible. But Oedipus discovers that it's him because he has this scar on his ankles. And Oedipus is like a translation of like scarred foot or something like that. So I tell this whole story of Oedipus, and also like Henry brings up Thebes because of all these associations. But personally, my mother had, as she lay dying, I was coming in every morning because she was sort of more lucid in the mornings. And she only spent a week in the hospital, and I did my best to make sure that she had all the palliative care possible and that she was not in pain. So I think that she was having these really amazing dreams. And I came in one day and she said, "It says Yates." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" And she said, "When you came in, you know, something said Yates." And so I had worked on the play Oedipus Rex at the Actors Studio for 2 years, from 2000 to 2001, with Al Pacino and Estelle Parsons and, you know, a whole list of movie stars. I was the stage manager, and I was the only non-famous person in the room. And the translation we were using was William Butler Yeats. And so there's this really funny connection that I have that I'm making right now, at least personally. And I feel also like if I say things out loud, that it'll help remember, or it'll help make them remembered in the world. So my mother had said, as I'm entering the room, like, "Yates, I think, was there." Or maybe Yates is following me. Or if you've ever read Dante's Inferno, Virgil is the person who helps lead Dante around the underworld. So I would love to think that my mother's hospital room had authors and, you know, writers in there, sort of waiting to help her navigate the next world that she was going to. She told me lots of other beautiful stuff. So, she had mentioned that she was, traveling around my hometown, which is, you know, not the town where she grew up, but the town where she, you know, established her marriage and where I was born and where she had been living for the past, you know, 50 years. And she was just telling me that she was at different places in the town, like at my kindergarten. And she told me, she's like, "I'm at the lights right before we go to Walden." So it's really funny, the associations that you have. And so I would like to believe that that Thoreau was mentioning Thebes because he's talking about this city that has been around for forever. Alexander the Great was visited there, and Thebes actually didn't really like him. And like, this is, you know, of all of the cities in the world that he could have chosen to mention in this section, he mentioned Thebes, which I personally appreciate. And anyway, so I think I shall leave it there, because I just think the rest of it is sort of funny, where he's talking about, "Here's how much I paid for sugar and lard and apples and dried apples, and all of these things, and the watermelon." Like, he used to have watermelon parties in August, and that's sort of a thing that they sometimes do at Walden Pond State Reservation. And I love how he has a whole section on, he translates a recipe from Cato 2 centuries before Christ. And he's like, "This is how I'm translating it. This is what you should do. And you shouldn't listen to the little old ladies who are going to tell you," you know, the very last line that I read, "The human race is interested in these experiments, though a few old women who are incapacitated for them, who own their thirds," which I take to mean widow's thirds in mills, "may be alarmed," because they really like the whole idea of flour and stuff. Thank you for listening.